They were burning debris without a permit, and they did leave that fire unattended.
The state files charges against an Anchorage couple for starting the Sockeye Fire. From the Alaska Public Radio Network, this is Alaska News Nightly for Monday, July 13th. Good evening, I'm Ann Hillman. Also tonight, a shellfish hatchery in Oregon adjusts to changing ocean conditions.
It's weird to think that, you know, 10 years ago we were running this hatchery with no treatment, and now we don't ever run with no treatment.
Those stories and more tonight on Alaska News Nightly.
Today's broadcast of Alaska News Nightly is presented by Raven Alaska, providing business travel needs in over 100 communities across the state. Find more at flyraven.com. And by Alaska Pipeline Service Company, committed to safety, operating the 800-mile Trans-Alaska Pipeline since 1977.
Two Anchorage adults have been charged with igniting the Sockeye Fire, which destroyed 55 homes near Willow in June. KSKA's Ellen Lockyer reports.
The point of ignition of the Sockeye Fire has been traced to an unattended burn pile on Willow property owned by Anchorage resident Greg Immig, age 59. Immig and Amy DeWitt, age 42, have been charged for their role in starting the 7,200-acre wildfire. According to State Fire Information Officer Tim Mowry, Immig and DeWitt did not have a burn permit for the debris pile located on forested lands at a recreational cabin owned by Immig.
They were burning debris without a permit, and they did leave that fire unattended, and it's just the worst case scenario. I mean, that's why it strictly says on our burn permits, and it's the one message we try to drive home to everybody, whether it's a debris burn, a campfire, a burn barrel, is never to leave any fire unattended.
According to Mowry, an investigation conducted by the State Division of Forestry and the State Fire Marshal's Office concluded the illegal burn was left unattended on the evening of June 13th. One of several of the burn piles smoldered and crept into the woods, resulting in the blaze that swept toward Willow on Sunday, causing evacuations Sunday night and Monday.
You know, to be clear, there was no burn suspension in place. So if these folks had have had a permit and had have been following the safe burning guidelines that are listed on that permit, they would have been, you know, within the law. It's tragic all the way around as to what happened.
Immig and DeWitt are to be arraigned in Palmer District Court on July 28th. Charges include three counts of reckless endangerment, criminally negligent burning, failure to obtain a burn permit, burning without clearing an area, and allowing the spread of fire and leaving a fire unattended. Mowry says that Amy DeWitt did make the 9/11 call to fire officials. The Sockeye wildfire moved so quickly that many evacuees had little time to gather more than a few items and rescue pets. The fire was fought with help from hotshot crews from the lower 48, and at one point there were more than 500 firefighters attacking the blaze. Tim Mowry.
Fighting it, the last report I had is the suppression cost $8 million.
In addition to the 55 homes lost, 44 additional structures were lost in the blaze. Individuals charged with starting a wildfire could be liable for up to two times the cost of fighting the fire. I'm Ellen Lockyer.
The state of Alaska has a commission whose sole purpose is to eliminate and prevent discrimination, but it can't do anything when it comes to gender identity or sexual orientation. Alaska is one of 28 states that doesn't have laws against it. KTOO's Lakedra Chavis reports.
Rachel Pettyjohn believes her hours were cut because she's gay.
They didn't fire me, they just cut down my hours to where I wasn't getting any hours.
Pettyjohn says she was discriminated against and humiliated at two tourism companies she's worked at since moving to Juneau 2 years ago. Since she still works in the industry, Pettyjohn declined to name them. During her first job, she says a supervisor implied that she was a pedophile. She says her boss was horrified after she made an innocent comment about a coworker's toddler.
I said, hey, your little girl's really cute. And she went, you said that? And I was like, what? You know? And she was like, I can't believe you said that. And I was like, what? And then it dawned on me. You know what I mean? She thought I was meaning it in that way. And it was just because I was gay. She wouldn't think that if it was a straight person.
But Pettyjohn says she didn't make a big deal about it.
I think I was embarrassed about it, to be honest.
Even if she could prove that she was discriminated against because of her identity, she wasn't protected by the law. Despite the U.S. Supreme Court legalizing same-sex marriage across the country, people who are lesbian, gay, bisexual, transgender, or queer are not consistently protected under federal law from workplace discrimination. Former Juneau Representative Beth Krutula, a Democrat, tried in 2011 and 2013 to outlaw this type of discrimination. Republican Representative Kathy Munoz is carrying the bill this time around. The Alaska Human Rights Commission documents discrimination complaints each year in their annual report, but doesn't include data on gender identity or sexual orientation discrimination.
Very few people contact us because they're concerned about discrimination based on lesbian, gay, transgender, queer issues because they know we don't cover those.
That's the commission's director, Paula Haley.
So they don't reach out to us because they know we don't have the ability to help them.
In the past few years, Haley says she's only seen a handful of cases. She says the U.S. Equal Employment Opportunity Commission is beginning to accept some LGBTQ claims, but this area of the law is complicated. LGBTQ employees who work for the state do have workplace protections, says Department of Administration Commissioner Sheldon Fisher.
So if someone claimed that they were not hired or were fired for reasons other than their ability to do the job, whatever those reasons might be, that's something that we would work with.
Drew Phoenix is director of Identity Incorporated, an Anchorage-based nonprofit that provides resources for the LGBTQ community. One of the services Identity provides is workplace cultural competency training, also referred to as sensitivity training.
There's no legal recourse at this point, you're correct, which is the really sad part. It's like we are, you know, our hands are tied, so we can't even report things at any point.
Phoenix says requests for the trainings have doubled in the past year. Identity has administered more than 20 since January. For tourism worker Rachel Pettyjohn, she's now at a third company, where she says her employers are welcoming and respect her sexual orientation. In Juneau, I'm Lakitra Chavez.
Thousands of so-called afterborns will be eligible for shares of the Calista Corporation. The preliminary results from a shareholder vote at Saturday's annual meeting in Kasigluk dramatically reshape the ownership of the YK Delta's regional Alaska Native Corporation. KYUK's Ben Matheson has more.
The prospect of enrolling the younger generation of YK Delta Alaska Natives has been discussed for years. Now, after the historic vote, Calista Communications Manager Tom Leonard says it too will take time to bring on the tens of thousands of new shareholders. That's expected to start in the first half of 2017.
This is going to be a long-term process. This is something that cannot happen overnight. We're going to be talking to other regional Alaska Native corporations that have enrolled their descendants, finding out what materials they use to process enrollment of descendants.
The move extends the shareholder base beyond people born before the cutoff date of December 18, 1971. Prior to passage of the binding resolution, younger people could only receive shares through inheritance or gifting. The company estimates that the number of shareholders could quickly increase from about 13,000 to between 38,000 and 43,000. With a tripling of shares, each individual shareholder would, on average, receive one-third the value of the shareholder dividends relative to the company prior to expansion. Last year's dividend averaged $380. Board Chair Willie Kasiley of Akyachuk says the company will benefit from the new voices.
And many of these younger people are highly educated now, and I think in that context, I welcome the enrollment of the descendants because of their ability to, you know, provide input to the operation of the company.
In addition to descendants, people who were eligible in 1971 but did not enroll can apply for shares. Enrollment will be ongoing when it starts in 2017. Leonard says that means newborn YK Delta Alaska Natives will be eligible upon birth for their corporate shares.
The parents will be able to apply to become a shareholder for them at any time. There won't be any open periods or anything like that.
The new shares will be life estate, meaning they only exist as long as the shareholder is alive. The company takes on additional administrative overhead with the growth. Implementing enrollment may cost $1 million. Establishing a quorum also becomes more complicated. While 60% of shareholders live in the YK Delta region now, that figure could drop to 55% with descendant enrollment. Chelista's grown from the 16th largest Alaska-owned company by revenues in 2010 to the 8th largest last year. They're active in several industries like aerospace, military contracting, real estate, and construction. They own subsurface rights to the Donlin Gold Prospect. Leonard says the company's focus will remain the same.
Chelista's day-to-day operations and strategies don't really change. Chelista will continue to work to be a successful company.
Chelista joins other corporations like the Arctic Slope Regional Corporation, Doyon, and Sea Alaska that have issued shares to descendants. The most recent was Otna in 2008. In Bethel, I'm Ben Matheson.
Still to come on Alaska News Nightly, a dramatic increase in bald eagle rescues near Haines.
Recently, there's just been an explosion of birds. Like, it's not uncommon for us to get at least one or two a week.
That's ahead. Stay with us.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by Northern Air Cargo, providing year-round transportation of all types of freight from vehicles and oversized equipment to small packages for corporations or small business. Northern Air Cargo, serving Alaska since 1956. And by First National Bank Alaska, where local knowledge and experience make the difference. We believe in Alaska. Learn more at fnbalaska.com. Equal housing lender, member FDIC.
A recent NOAA study named 2040 as the date for the potential end of Alaskan shellfish hatcheries. That is, unless serious mitigation efforts are put into place to combat ocean acidification. Last week, we reported on the research done at the Aleutik Pride Shellfish Hatchery in Seward. Now, we'll take a look at what a hatchery on the Oregon coast is doing to deal with these harmful changes in ocean chemistry. KBBI's Shady Grove Oliver has more.
The Whiskey Creek Shellfish Hatchery is located in the small town of Tillamook, Oregon.
This hatchery was started by Lee Hansen. It was really the first shellfish hatchery that was commercial in operation. Started in 1978.
Sue Cudd owns the hatchery now. She studied biology in school, worked for an oyster company for a while, and then came on with Lee Hansen to learn about the hatchery world. From the 1970s until 2006, there were natural ups and downs, but overall, things ran relatively smoothly.
Then all of a sudden, you know, at about 2006, we started seeing some pretty major problems. And then from like the end of 2007, all through 2008, we couldn't produce larvae anymore.
For a year and a half, they tried to produce. Even when they did manage to get some larvae, they wouldn't survive and develop. It was a financial nightmare for the business.
We lose money really fast because the production cost was the same without having any production. So it was tough. We got help from some customers, the Oyster Growers Association, and one of our state senators got us some community development money, so we had time to be able to try to solve the problem. Without that, I don't know what would have happened because we just lost money so fast.
They weren't sure what to do, but they figured they should start with looking at the water. They hired an oceanographer consultant and got in touch with OSU's marine lab. They brought in specialized equipment and began evaluating the water's pH and other levels several times a day. Wiley Evans is a researcher at the NOAA Pacific Marine Environment Lab in Seattle. He was the project lead at Aleutik Pride in Seward and says what Sue Cudd is describing is now seen as a defining time in this field of research. They've become a model for studying and coping.
The classic is at Whiskey Creek Hatchery on the Oregon coast, the first hatchery to really start making these measurements. With help from Burke Hales at Oregon State University.
Burke Hales is the namesake of the Burkeolator, an instrument now used at both sites to measure partial pressure of carbon dioxide, or PCO2, in the ocean. Cudd says the equipment brought in led them to find that levels of carbon dioxide in the water were much higher than they'd expected. In fact, lots of measurements seemed out of whack. But why had it taken them nearly 2 years of lost product to figure it out?
We didn't know why we couldn't produce larvae because we really never knew why we could. You know, we didn't know what conditions they needed. We didn't know what their parameters were because we just never needed to. They grew. So then when we started having problems, we had to go back and try to figure out what was wrong with the water.
And that's her first piece of advice for hatcheries. If you haven't started taking measurements already, start now. And the Aleutik Pride study is doing just that, says Evans.
So we wanted to set a baseline, because really the shellfish aquaculture industry in Alaska is very young. And so right now there's one shellfish hatchery, and we're making measurements in that hatchery. And so we wanted to set a baseline that could be something that the industry uses as a guideline for moving forward in the future.
Cudd says based on daily and seasonally fluctuating CO2 and acidity levels, Whiskey Creek has developed a system to compensate. They buffer the water in their production tanks with injections of sodium carbonate. The carbonate helps organisms like clams and mussels develop their shells, which they can't do in unusually acidic water. Aleutic Pride is considering that now as an option for the future.
It's weird to think that, you know, 10 years ago we were running this hatchery with no treatment, and now we don't ever run with no treatment.
And that's been the direct cost of acidification to her hatchery. The carbonate is relatively cheap, but the whole operation has changed. They've had to integrate lots of expensive equipment into their daily work. Staff have to constantly monitor it, maintain it, make adjustments here and there. She asks if such a drastic change could happen over the course of just a year and a half, what could happen next?
It's incredible. I mean, it opens your eyes. It makes you see things very differently.
And researchers and hatcheries in Alaska are now looking to places like Whiskey Creek for clues on how to deal with the serious issue that is ocean acidification. In Homer, I'm Shady Grove Oliver.
The Nooshiegak River is becoming one of Alaska's premier destinations for king salmon sport fishermen. The king return to the Nooshiegak is proving stronger this year than last, and Fish and Game says they're on track to meet the escapement goal. But KDLG's Matt Martin reports that the sport fishing guides say the angling has been less than average.
Years of experience have taught Nancy Morris Lyon that the sweet spot for catching kings is a water temperature right between 52 and 54 degrees. But hot weather in Bristol Bay has put the water temperature well into the 60s.
Between that and the bright light, which tends to make all fish want to head for the bottom, it's definitely had an effect on I feel it's had a major effect on what we've seen as far as the king catch this year.
Lyon is the managing partner of the Bear Trail Lodge in King Salmon. Her clients pay big money to catch kings on the Nooshiegak, one of the best king-producing rivers in the world. Fish and Game manages to put 95,000 kings in the Nooshiegak River and is on track to meet that goal this year, but that hasn't translated into anglers landing kings in regular numbers.
You know, we've been catching a lot more of the smaller fish, and for the numbers that they're seeing in their return through the sonar counter, we're not seeing that kind of numbers in relative percentages to past years in the boat. So we're definitely not catching what I would say is a normal catch for sport fishermen.
Matt Norman, manager of King Salmon Lodge, has been seeing fewer bites from kings as well. He says a recent corporate group fishing for kings was less than satisfied.
And it was a real bust. We had like 22 guests. I think if we caught 3 kings out of 22 people, it was a good day.
Norman says after that trip, the organizer of the group told him they loved the lodge and that the food was great.
But, you know, if we want to stand and not catch fish, we can do that on a Kenai without the airfare to King Salmon.
That's why Norman says he's going to book more guests to fish for silvers later in the season.
August, knock on wood, has been a really good year. Last part of July through August for silvers has been pretty steady out here.
He's already booked that same corporate group to come back next August to fish for silvers instead of kings. But Nancy Morris Lyon isn't giving up on the Nooshiegak King run.
These things are all very cyclical, so I'm rather reluctant to say that I feel like it's a doomed fishery or that we're seeing the end of it.
Lyon says the Nooshiegak is a long way from becoming like the poor king run on the Kenai.
But I think it's something that needs to be watched. I think we need to be very conscientious and watch and see what our numbers do on some of our years that have more norms for the temperatures and weather rather than this year.
Lyon describes herself as an eternal optimist, which she says is a requirement to be a successful fishing guide. So, until next year. In Dillingham, I'm Matt Martin.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by ConocoPhillips, investing in oil and gas production and creating jobs and business opportunities for Alaskans. ConocoPhillips, Alaska's oil and gas company. Alaska Pacific University offers an affordable education, small class sizes, and life-friendly schedules designed to support your personal and professional goals. APU is still accepting applications for fall 2015. Find out about financial aid and the Promise Tuition Grant and apply online at alaskapacific.edu before Saturday, August 1st. This message sponsored by Alaska Pacific University.
Starting today, Juneau residents will be able to walk into the police department and hand over drugs without consequence. It's been several months since the community could safely dispose of prescription medications. KTOO's Elizabeth Jenkins has more.
Adam Nelson is the lead pharmacist at Juneau Drug, a quaint, old-fashioned pharmacy in the heart of downtown. He started working here when he was 14 and became a pharmacist 5 years ago. He says his favorite thing about the job is the people.
Talking to them, finding out about their day, and helping them any way that I can, if I can.
But something that can be difficult to help customers with is what to do with leftover prescription pills. He says they inquire once or twice a week. Can I drop this off here?
Because they went to the dentist, they give them 20 pain pills in case they need them. They only take three, and they need somewhere to put them. And most people in Juneau don't just want to throw them in the garbage.
Trace amounts of medication flushed on the toilet or thrown in a landfill can wind up in your drinking water.
Let's say you go to the dump and you throw a handful of pills in the dump. It's going to rain. All of that rainwater is going to turn it into muck, and eventually it's going to turn into liquid and just flow out into the streams and the creeks.
Twice a year, the DEA, along with the Juneau Police Department, would round up surplus pharmaceuticals. But that program ended last year after funding was cut. Lieutenant Chris Sell from JPD says disposal options were non-existent.
People were justifiably frustrated when they were trying to do the right thing and there wasn't an avenue to responsibly and legally dispose of their extra medications.
Now with the RX drug drop.
And so now I'm opening up the slot. I'm going to drop that in there.
People can walk in and safely get rid of their meds.
And it falls through to the waste paper basket.
The model has worked successfully in other places, like Ketchikan. The police department there has been doing it for about 2.5 years. Sell says people can drop off their medications anonymously.
There's no forms to fill out. It's just like a book drop-off box at the library.
Last year, JPD confiscated 374 prescription opioid pills. They can elicit the same effect on the brain as heroin. Sell says addiction can start at home and lead to harder substances.
When we talk to addicted people, they almost always started with taking someone's prescription drugs.
The Juneau Police Department hopes with the addition of the RX drug drop, it won't come to that. In Juneau, I'm Elizabeth Jenkins.
The American Bald Eagle Foundation in Haines has seen a dramatic increase in bird rescues and they're asking for the public's help. The foundation plans to form a volunteer avian rescue team. KHNS's Emily Files reports.
The word that Eagle Foundation staff keep using to describe the spike in bird rescues is intense.
Yeah, it's been a wave of birds. Just very intense. Pretty intense, I suppose.
That's Raptor curator Chloe Goodson and education and outreach coordinator Leah Minch. They say in the past, they've been called to one or two bird rescues throughout the entire year. So far this year, they've done 16 bird rescues. That includes eagles, ravens, hummingbirds, and more.
Recently, there's just been an explosion of birds. Like, it's not uncommon for us to get at least one or two a week.
Here's Eagle Foundation Director Cheryl McRoberts.
I've been here 7 years, and this is the busiest we've ever been with injured birds.
The past week alone has been a record-breaking one, McRoberts says. They've rescued 3 eagles and 1 raven. Here's Goodson.
For the past few eagles, it's been a lot of trauma, like probably hit by a car, probably ran into something.
Minch explains the most recent eagle rescue she went on. The foundation got a call from police about an injured bird near Mud Bay Road.
So we went down there, put a net over it, you get control of the head to get a towel over it. There's kind of a theory with raptors that what they can't see, they can't fear. So you want to cover up their visual senses. and then get them into a crate and take them back here to do triage, figure out kind of what could be wrong with them, and try to take as good notes as we possibly can so that the vets down in Sitka or kind of have an idea of what's going on with the bird.
There's no full-time veterinarian in Haines, so the foundation sends injured eagles to the Alaska Raptor Center in Sitka. The Raptor Center said on their Facebook page that June was their busiest month ever, with 20 injured bald eagles being sent in. So far in July, they've admitted 6 eagles. The Haines Eagle Foundation staff say they don't know what's causing the dramatic increase in injured birds. They say it could partly be that people are more aware that the Eagle Foundation does bird rescues.
Another thing to think about is that this is a really, really warm, dry year, so food availability may not, for the raptors, for eagles, may not be as good as it has been in previous years.
Local birdwatcher and counter Pam Randles thinks food scarcity could have something to do with it. She says this summer she's observed more desperate behavior in birds searching for food. She's seen birds fighting over food, eagles trying to steal fish from people, and other risky behavior. It's speculation, but Randall says that kind of risk-taking could lead to more injuries. Whatever the cause, the staff at the Eagle Foundation have decided they need more manpower to deal with the influx of avian injuries.
We do need help, and if you're interested in just going on rescues, that's great.
Goodson says volunteers on the avian rescue team will be trained in how to handle an injured bird and bring it to the foundation. Having a few more people on call to help will take some of the burden off the foundation's 3 trained raptor handlers. The foundation has set up a cell phone that they'll pass around to staff and volunteers. Whoever has the phone will be the on-call raptor rescuer. Here's McRoberts.
On the last eagle that we had, it was on a Sunday and everybody was off. And I got the phone call and I was in a panic. I was running around knocking on doors trying to find help. So if we had some volunteers, that would really be helpful.
Reporting in Haines, I'm Emily Files.
And that's all for this edition of Alaska News Nightly. If you missed any of tonight's stories, we're online at alaskapublic.org. Follow us on Twitter at APRN. We had reports tonight from Ellen Lockyer in Anchorage, Lakedra Chavis and Elizabeth Jenkins in Juneau, Ben Matheson in Bethel, Shady Grove Oliver in Homer, Matt Martin in Dillingham, and Emily Files in Haines. Our editor and producer is Annie Feit. Our audio engineer is Dave Waldron. Monica Gokey is our web editor. I'm Ann Hillman. Have a great night.
Alaska News Nightly was made possible by Wells Fargo, extending its support of Alaska residents beyond banking by supporting the programming of public radio throughout Alaska, giving back to the community. Wells Fargo, together we'll go far. And by Spinard Builder Supply. For more than 60 years, SBS has helped Alaskans build from ground to roof to everything in between. Spinard Builder Supply is here to build with you. Many Alaskans who die in boating accidents don't die of hypothermia. Without a life jacket, drowning kills long before hypothermia does. More at pledgetolive.org. This message sponsored by Alaska Office of Boating Safety.
Garrison Keillor, one of the most beloved radio hosts and acclaimed humorists, is coming to the Alaska State Fair with his America the Beautiful tour on Sunday, August 30th at 3 p.m. This 2.5-hour show will feature Prairie Home Companion classics with piano master Richard Dworsky, sound effects man Fred Newman, and other special guests. Tickets at alaskastatefair.org. This message sponsored by the Alaska State Fair.
This is APRN, the Alaska Public Radio Network.